This is the Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Joe Cohen from Queen's College.
I'm Leslie Hingson from Georgetown University.
Gabriel Rossman can't be with us today. We're on the web, theannexpodcast.com, on Twitter at SocAnnex, and on Facebook, The Annex Sociology Podcast. Today, we're very happy to be sitting down with Christine Prochesky of Northwestern University. Christine is an expert on family demography, economic stratification, and health policy. Recently, her and her colleague Jess Meyer published some great articles on union dissolution. Most recently, Health and Union Dissolution Among Parenting Couples, Differences by Gender and Marital Status in the Journal of Health and Social Behavior. We're going to talk about marriage, cohabitation, separation, parenting, and much more. You're not going to want to miss this. In my opinion, this is by far the biggest news of the past week. The Chinese scientist who claimed to have gene edited two baby girls. Have you guys heard about this one?
Yes.
Right. Like in 500 years from now, no one's going to care about Trump or Twitter. Right. But if this guy actually did what he said he did, and you never know with people, but if it did happen, I mean, this is big news. So a few days ago at an international summit on theory of human gene editing, there was a Chinese scientist whose name was, pardon the pronunciation, I think it's Jian Kui He, and he claimed to have gene edited two twin girls to make them resistant to the HIV virus. They were part of an experiment involving couples where there was like an HIV positive father and an HIV negative mother, and they wanted to help these HIV positive fathers have children so who were uninfected by the disease. So they used a technology known as the CRISPR, which allows you to cut out and replace pieces of DNA, and they used them on embryos. So before you start cracking on China, these were illegal in China.
Yeah.
So it's not legal. And I read a BBC article, apparently the norms governing embryo research is you do the gene modification, but you don't fertilize the embryos, or you don't let the embryos come to term. But he claims to have done it. Any thoughts on this one? The potential that the first gene edited human beings have been born.
Well, as the only one on this show right now who was a guest on Bill Nye Saves the World to actually discuss these issues, I think I will begin. Right? So for me, there are two things, right? So the first is, this is wicked scary, right? Oh, yeah. In many ways. And for me, the scariest part is, you know, we still know so very little about gene environment interactions.
Yes.
That even if we know that we have identified the gene, right, responsible for encoding or being susceptible to AIDS or HIV, I should say, and you edit that out, we have absolutely no idea what that's going to do to the rest of you, uh-huh. Right? That's number one. And number two, I actually get really upset about the way in which the media is framing this in terms of a discussion about designer babies, right?
Yeah.
Because to me, like, designer is like, you know, that's some extra stuff, right? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's like, okay, I need a handbag. I'm going to go up to a Louis Vuitton, right? Mm-hmm. And what this scientist was attempting to do wasn't something trivial like, yeah, oh, blue eyes versus brown, right? This was actually trying to actually ensure resistance to a life-threatening disease.
Mm-hmm. For me, some of the issues that come up with this, at least reading the media, some of the coverage of this, is it sounds like the scientists did not have what I would consider to be adequate consent from the parents. Yeah. So it sounds like he presented some pretty misleading information to his team and to the parents, and that he did not have the collaboration and support of the scientific and scholarly community.
Yeah.
And to me, this raises, if this is not morally problematic, why did he not do these things in the appropriate way? And the fact that he didn't suggests he knows it's morally problematic on so many levels.
This is like some Island of Dr. Moreau stuff.
Yes. And so even if the outcome or long term, we think that this ends up, you know, saving people from a lot of suffering and has no downstream negative implications. The fact that he went about it in this way suggests that he knows there's problematic parts of it. And it's sort of fruit of the poisonous tree here, right? Like,
yeah,
we just can't accept this.
Like, on one hand, yes, it's very scary and against the scientific community's wishes. But, like, on the other hand, he presented it at a conference about gene editing theory, right? Like, we're working on it. Like, let's not – like, what are they? There's no conferences on unicorns because that's not going to happen. But, like, who are we fooling, you know?
Yeah,
so,
right.
Everybody's gearing up for it. Here are my takes. Number one, everybody hates the IRB, right? And then you hear stories like this.
And you're like, oh, wait, there is a reason we have IRBs, right?
No kidding, eh? And number two, like, gene editing is coming. And everybody who refuses to mess with their genes is probably going to end up in the underclass, right? Is that what's going to happen, basically?
I don't think so.
No.
You know what? It's really scary, right? Because you're like, then, like, there's a slippery slope. Like, even if we're not talking about, like, what we call designer baby stuff, is like, what ends up, what aspects of a person's, like, genome ends up being seen as inadequate, right?
Or undesirable.
Or undesirable, or even seen as a disorder, right? Or abnormal, right? It's like, you know what I mean? If this was going down like 300 years ago, you know what I mean? Or actually, I shouldn't say 300 years ago, right after emancipation, I'm sure they'd be editing out anything having to do with my melanin at this point in time, right? And that's problematic. Like, I have a student who's working on this, who's working on a project looking at, I'm trying to remember what the disorder is called, but it's the disorder that is, that's associated with individuals, being, what's called abnormally short, having abnormally short stature, and how more and more families, especially families with boys, are opting to give them human growth hormone because that's seen as abnormal and something that will limit their life chances. What other things are we going to start medicalizing in this way and believing we need to edit out?
And we don't know too what diseases will come down the pike that by editing the human genome, we've gotten rid of some possibility of resistance and some set of genes that might be protective, right?
Yep. Sickle cell trait, for example.
It's like unintended consequences. But here's the thing. It is coming, right? Like, it's coming. There's no way we're going to stop. Is this something that we should be fighting tooth and nail? Or is this something like it's going to happen, so we might as well start planning for a smooth transition into our genetically engineered stage of human history where we're all like, you know, lab-managed beings?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Like, even one of the scientists who actually helped to develop CRISPR, I remember watching her in an interview and she was saying, like, she'd had this dream, right? That, you know, the people at her institution, I can't remember where she is, you know, the head of her department said, oh, there's someone who's really interested in your work who'd really like to meet you. And they walk into the conference room and the chair spins around and it's Adolf Hitler.
Oh, geez.
Right? And, you know, so even she is like, oh, my
God.
Like, what hath we wrought?
Yes. And maybe some of this is, I don't want to say inevitable, but definitely coming, but I don't think that means that we have to abandon all the questions about it or give up any attempt at regulation or scientific consensus or dialogue with, you know, folks concerned with ethics and religion. And right, I think this needs to be a much deeper, longer discussion that's probably subject to some sort of international agreements and regulation.
Oh, yeah.
I wonder. So you figure by the time we're all grandparents and our grandchildren come and tell us that they're pregnant and they're looking to have an 8-foot-tall.
I don't think they were going to be. I don't think it's coming that soon. I mean, my kids are younger than yours, but I don't think it's coming that soon.
well, maybe that'll be a definitive 4-year difference.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, but I think there are two issues here, right? I mean, I think that the scientific community will come together in order to create, you know, rules and regulations and, you know, and have like a very long list of things that can and cannot be done.
Yes.
But that doesn't prevent rogue people, right, from going off and using the technology for other means.
It does not. Yeah.
So Leslie, have you been doing work on CRISPR? Or?
No. So I haven't been, I have not been doing work on CRISPR at all. Like I just, like the work that I do really is just looking at race and the whole new genomic revolution and what that means in terms of whether or not, you know, we're doing yet another 180 and saying, you know what, forget about the whole social constructionist, you know, sort of view of race that we have. We are going into this whole brave new world where, God darn it, we are going to find those genes that show us that race is actually a genetic thing. Right. That's what I'm most, that's the work that I'm doing. This whole CRISPR thing was just Bill Nye called and I showed up.
Why not? Right.
Yeah.
You don't say no to Bill Nye.
No, you don't.
Yesterday, that'd be November 27th, I was reading The Atlantic and I saw this piece on the mental health effects of graduate school. It's a piece by Aaliyah Wong. You guys read that one? You see it?
I didn't see it.
I mean, but we've all been through the process and we know that the process is unhealthy. Look, in a nutshell, it's it reports on another study that shows that there's high rates of like anxiety and depression among doctoral students. And, you know, now, I mean, look, grad school is far enough in the rear view mirror. Like, what is it about grad school, in your opinion, that is so soul crushing? Because I do remember it being a time of anxiety and depression for me, too. Like, what is it about graduate school now that we're running the programs or, you know, like what is there anything we can do? Or do you think it's just an inescapable facet of the business where like being a professor is like trying to be a musician and it's just a super hard goal? It feels futile. Like, what is it?
I don't know. Well, for me, like I kind of felt like one of the weirdest things about graduate school for me, it was how infantilizing it was.
Yes.
Right. Totally. And so, you know, you're like, okay, I'm a grown up. Like I came to grad school with a kid, for goodness sake. Right. And then all of a sudden you're kind of put back in this place where you're like, okay, you know what I mean? I am being assessed in a way that I'm not actually really sure what the metrics are. Mm-hmm. And I'm being told sometimes, like this never happened to me, but I would hear stories from fellow graduate students in other departments where they were like, they're being told basically when they could and couldn't start a family, mm-hmm. right? Because you're like, sorry, I will not be your advisor if you do this because, you know, I mean, so infantilized. So just when you thought you were an adult, mm-hmm. like you're made into like an anxiety ridden, angst driven teenager mm-hmm. all over again.
And then in some disciplines too, I think there is this, people are so dependent or reliant on a single professor or advisor, mm-hmm. their good recommendation, their whatever, that it does create extra stress. You need to be extra responsive to this one person who may or may not have your best interests at heart, who may or may not be engaging in fair practices or giving great feedback, mm-hmm. coupled with a really demanding job market where we know a lot of these PhD students will not get great jobs. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then let's not forget about the low incomes of graduate students. We have a lot of research which suggests poverty does bad things to people's health.
Right? Yeah, you think? Yeah.
And even at universities where grad students are above the poverty level, they're not making tons of money. And many of them have lots of responsibilities and face high rent costs, childcare costs, other healthcare costs. And so this is, it's not a good combination.
And then my final thing, I think that a lot of people go into academia with these really idealistic notions of what it is. It's a meritocracy, and we get to read and think about big ideas, and that's the totality of it. And it's not, it's brutal. And I think also in a lot of departments, it's a winner take all market, right? Yes. So you're like, okay, who's our number one student in this cohort? Right. Everybody pile onto that number one student. Everyone else is like, what about me? Mm-hmm. Right. I thought that getting in here was the prize. And I think that it actually causes a lot of disillusionment among many people, especially those who went to academia thinking that it was just a place of ideas, a void of politics, and we're all doing this communally and together.
You know, even with I had an amazing advisor. Miguel Centeno is one of the finest human beings I've ever met in this business, and he was an amazing mentor, but I was still stressed. I think it was the uncertainty.
Yes.
First of all, I mean, whenever you go to a PhD program, you're used to being the smartest kid in the room. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you get plopped together with all these super smart people, and you're like, well, there goes a core part of my identity out the window. Yeah. And then the other part is like, it's weird. It's very hard to really train somebody to be good. Like, how do you train somebody to discover something? How do you train? Like, and as I move up through the process, I realize that the distance between professors and graduate students is not as big as we might think when we're in the process. No. Like, everybody's just trying to sling something. Nobody can get into ASR on demand. Right. And like, if your advisor had an amazing idea, your advisor would probably be using that idea to get into AJS themselves, unless they just didn't want to bother. Like, some people's nests are so feathered, I suppose. But like, it's the uncertainty is crippling, and just the lack of jobs. But
that said, I mean, I think there are organizational practices and cultural and some organizational cultures which are more supportive of graduate students than others. And it's amazing how even within the same university, there's differences across departments in how well supported graduate students feel, how well
included. No, for sure. Yes. Yeah.
And so, you know, some part of this might be hard to change, but other parts are definitely within the scope of what departments and universities can change and can affect. And it's not just improving mental health services. It's also changing local cultures to create the sense that graduate students are valued and important.
So,
and that's something that we can all do on the small level, but that is also a challenge for us collectively in departments and universities.
So we have a lot of grad students who are listeners. What advice, like looking back, now that you've been through the mill, been chewed up and spit out, what advice would you give our younger colleagues who are in the middle of that very stressful process?
Christine.
I would advise them to find supportive friends in other departments or disciplines, people who can relate to the same experiences of being a graduate student, but are not the people they are competing with directly for jobs. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think that I'd have two bits of advice. The first is, you know what I mean? It's important to find an advisor, right? Who can like help you through the whole publication process and all that, but you need to find a good mentor. And that mentor does not have to be in your department. Right. It just has to be someone who can help you maintain like a healthy, like life work balance, mm-hmm. check in on you to make sure that you're happy. Right. You know, go out for a drink every once in a while. I think we sometimes need that. And I think very often you need that from outside of your department, right? Because you're like, that's a professional face. You don't want anyone to see you weak, which I actually think is a crock.
Total crock.
But yeah, so that's number one. And the second thing I would say is, you know, at every step of your graduate career, like, I think you should be evaluating whether it's worth it.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. And whether it's the best fit for you.
Yeah.
About what are your goals? What are your intentions? Why are you there?
Yeah. You're like, can't I do this? Can't I do this and still go to business school and make millions of dollars? Right? I don't know.
My advice would be along yours. You know what I think a big problem is people go in with an all or nothing mentality. I want to be an academic. And like once you get the job, it's a job. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just a regular job and you go home to your kids and you make money. And, you know, there's lots of ways to have a fulfilling life. So have a plan B. Like right. Think about going into the private sector. You can be just as respected or just as much or earn way more. Mm-hmm. And have a great family. You can have everything that you hope to get in a life as an academic. I think I fetishized being an academic. And, you know, it's a job. It's a wonderful job. I'm very grateful to have it. But I wish I weren't so vested.
Yeah, no. No, Joel, even
there are great jobs in government and there's great jobs in nonprofit.
Yeah, even my five-year-old, like, is quick to remind me, yeah, but you're not a real doctor, Mom.
Yeah, right.
So.
So yesterday, the UN issued a report that said that more than half of the planet's richest countries, that includes Canada, Australia, South Korea, the US, much of Europe, they're not cutting carbon pollution. In fact, I read a report that said they're further behind their 2030 targets than they expected to be or than they were previously. So things are getting worse. And the report said that countries are going to have to triple their efforts to reach the 2 degrees Celsius target by 2013. And I don't know which countries you follow. I know that in Canada, people are turning against Trudeau over a carbon tax. And in America, it's just finished. I mean, I don't think we're going to see any progress on climate change. But like 2030 is what, 12 years away?
Yeah.
And like we're going to have two more years of Republican president. So it's 2021 before there's a White House that's willing to do anything. I don't want to be partisan about it, but realistically right. speaking, I think that's the situation.
Right.
And I'd like to put that in perspective. You guys remember Bjorn Lomborg's book, The Skeptical Environmentalist?
Oh, yes.
That was 17 years ago. Okay. 12 years to 20. Remember Al Gore's movie?
Right. Yes.
That was 12 years ago. Okay. Yes. So, like, that's how long between now and 2030 is. That's yes. how long there is. And there's supposed to be some really serious consequences, right? Like, apparently, yes. I heard, like, Midwestern farms are going to produce, like, 75% less corn. Mm. And, like, the ocean's going to acidify. People are going to be displaced. There's predictions of disease problems. So, I'm feeling.
And we're seeing all the natural disasters.
Are they tied to climate change? Like, have they determine that like these extreme weather events are a product of climate change?
I think quite a few of them have been tied to climate change.
I think it's impossible to say that or most scientists would not say that any specific one is, but it right. seems like the consensus from what I've seen is that at least the uptick in the number of these massive natural disaster type events mm-hmm. is likely related to climate change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also things like, you know, hurricanes, right? Mm-hmm. Not so, and they can't say like exactly that the rise in the number of hurricanes has to do with climate change. But there are certain things like, you know, the fact that like some of the hurricanes, rather than like moving quickly, will escalate and then just hover over a certain spot for, mm-hmm. you know, for a certain amount of time, right. that's been correlated with the rise in sea temperatures. Yes. So,
well, this has me feeling quite hopeless.
Yeah.
So is climate change coming? Like, is it just going to happen? Because that's what it's looking like.
I mean,
to me.
I think there are still things that can be done, but and I've forgotten the demographer who put out this model, but there's the idea that the environmental impact is a function of population size, affluence, and technology. And so folks who've been taking this perspective have seen growing world populations, fortunately seen the growing affluence of world populations, right? Particularly thinking about China and India and the massive uplift of folks out of poverty there. That's a good thing, but it means that people are eating more meat, that people are driving more cars, that large parts of the world population have a higher standard of living, and that often produces carbon.
So they're polluting like us.
The T part of that is technology. So we have seen big changes in technologies which mitigate some of that impact, but those changes in technology are not keeping up with the growing affluence and demand for things like diets that produce more carbon, mm-hmm. transportation that produces more carbon, et cetera.
Which, you know what I mean? Like, part of me actually believes that if we put higher value or higher dollar signs on technology that would help to reduce carbon, you know what I mean? We'd have all these young kids who are about to get out of college instead of trying to find the next big social media platform, right? They'd be working on this.
Yes, they would be. Yes. And so I think there is a role here. And I hate to say anything that is inevitable because history proves that's not true, right? There have been many points in the past where people have predicted some upcoming disaster that they thought was impossible to avoid, that then there was some great development that really turned everything on its head. Mm-hmm. At the same time, we know it is hard to turn things on their head, and getting the world population all on the same page is not going to be easy. And it also seems deeply unfair to me that we say to populations in middle income countries that no, they can't use these technologies because it's going to hurt the earth. And yet folks in the richest countries like us in the US or folks in Canada, it's okay for them to, right?
Mm-hmm. Or it's okay that we actually made it so that you can't.
That's right. That's right.
So
that's right.
So if you were advising, let's say we expect it to happen, what are, you know, what do you, does sociology have anything to contribute to, like, helping us head off a disaster or helping us adapt to a climate disaster? Like, where can we help?
I think we need to be very aware of the fact that this is going to unequally impact the least advantaged, both globally and within our own societies.
Yeah, and I think also as sociologists, I think that we actually can play a role in commenting on, like, what I really, really believe is this late stage capitalism era, right? Where we need to actually think about ways to actually better respond and better create incentives to doing things for good, right? How do we create market incentives, right? That can actually do good things, right? As opposed to simply allowing this thing that's called the market, right? That says that we all have to be disinterested and we all have to be following our own self-interest and then let the market say, like, what the value of a thing is, and there will go. I mean, like, who could have predicted 40 years ago that a thing like Twitter, right, would have the valuation that it does? You'd be like, oh, that's a cute thing, kid, right? You know what I mean? Like, somebody go make me a new Xerox machine, right?
And clearly the market for low carbon products and technologies that mitigate carbon effects, those are impacted by government policies, government incentives, the structure of markets, all of these things that we do have some control over or could. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. and other wealthy industrialized countries need to take a leading role here.
Yeah,
those technologies are going to be developed here.
I think that's what – I think the U.S. leadership role is a thing. You know, from a Canadian
– well, too late for that.
But there could be private incentives here too, or California. Some of our states could be building incentives, even if we're not building them at the federal level. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And now we turn to Christine Prochesky from Northwestern University. Christine recently published two terrific articles on union dissolution. Last year in PLOS One, she and Jess Meyer published Health Behaviors in Union Dissolution Among Parents of Young Children, Differences by Marital Status. And more recently, the two published Health and Union Dissolution Among Parenting Couples, Differences by Gender and Marital Status in the Journal of Health and Social Behavior. They were terrific articles, Christine.
Oh, thank you.
So it's a pleasure to have you join us. Thank you for coming.
I'm so excited to talk about this new research.
It was really good. I loved it. So, and it's always great when someone you know and like is doing great work. It's a So wait, let's start off with some basics, because, you know, everybody comes from a different, you know, subsection of the field.
Sure.
You study union dissolution, right? So maybe.
Right. So
go ahead.
Think about divorce or breaking up among cohabiting couples.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And you do it among parents, right?
Parents. So, right.
Wait, cohabitation is on the rise. How prevalent is it among parents?
Yeah. So about 1 in 5 kids are born to a cohabiting couple.
Interesting. So they're both of their biological parents are cohabiting when they are born.
That's right. Couples living together, but not married. And it's much more common than it was just a few decades ago. And many of our studies to date on parents and dynamics between parents have thought about two camps of folks. They've thought about married couples where both biological parents are married to each other. And here we're thinking mothers and fathers, because up until recently, at least in the US case, same-sex marriage wasn't available across the US. So most of those studies have looked at moms and dads married to each other, and the contrast has been single mom families. And in recent decades, we've seen a lot more family diversity, along with the rise of moms and dads living together, but who aren't married together, married to each other. Yeah.
And then, first of all, why do they think cohabitation is on the rise among parents who are parenting the same child?
That's a great question. There's a lot of different answers to this. In short, marriage has become less socially necessary, and it's become more feasible for folks to live together without being married. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, the symbolic value of marriage has risen such that many couples and popular society has in place all these expectations, like folks shouldn't get married unless they have some savings. Folks shouldn't get married unless they have money for a big showy wedding. Folks shouldn't get married if they still have a lot of debt or if somebody has an addiction, a substance addiction, or if there's still romantic infidelity or sexual infidelity. And so the bar for what makes a good marriage has risen.
Oh, interesting.
And the resources that people have in some parts of the population have shrunk. So combined with new norms about that it's okay for people to live together without being married. So it's this combination of cultural factors and structural factors and all coming together.
Yeah. So Christine, I have two questions. So the first is, how much of this has to do with, you know, what people have been saying is like the growing secularization of the United States, right? Which, you know, we're still a fairly religious country, right. but we seem to be becoming less so, number one. And number two, the fact that it used to be that when we thought about people who cohabited and even parents who cohabited, we tended to think about lower income individuals, people with lower levels of education. Whereas right. like, from what I understand, there's actually been like a pretty significant increase in cohabiting parents who actually have relatively high levels of education.
Yeah. So there, so on the first part of that, yes, the religiosity of the US is interesting because we're much more religious country than, let's say, most of Western Europe. Mm-hmm. And that probably has something to do with what's going on here in that we have lower levels of cohabiting parenthood than some countries in Western Europe. Mm-hmm. And cohabiting parenthood is less common among the most religious folks in the US. But that said, we have seen this decline in religiosity, and it's even become more common among folks who are religious. Mm-hmm. So the religiosity part of it is complicated, but it's probably part of the story.
Okay.
Regarding the education gradient, yes, there's been an increase in the share of, let's say, people with a college education who have kids while cohabiting and don't wait for marriage to do that. But it is still most common among those with the least education. Mm-hmm. It's moving up through the middle class a bit. So it used to be that it was predominantly among people without a high school degree. And now it's a lot of those some college folks. It's still pretty uncommon for college educated women to have their babies in cohabiting unions instead of in marriage. Mm-hmm.
So wait, tell us a little bit about your studies in particular. So the first one looked at smoking and binge drinking,
right?
Which I understand those to be health problems, right? Like I understand both of your papers to be about the relationship between health problem and separating.
That's right. And so, you know, health conditions and health behaviors are somewhat different. But so thinking about starting with health behaviors, right, there's reasons that we might think it's hard to parent your children well if you binge drink regularly or if you're smoking regularly. So
smoking, you think so?
Yes. I mean, there's all this research that secondhand smoke is not good for children.
Fair enough.
And so, you know, it's hard to effectively supervise children if you have to keep leaving the home to smoke outside. And if you don't leave the home to smoke outside, then you're exposing your children to secondhand smoke. Mm-hmm. And in the U.S. context, we've also put on high taxes onto smoking and onto the sale of cigarettes, which means, you know, it's a substantial part of some families' budgets, or it's a substantial hit to budgets to maintain a smoking habit. So, you know, certainly some families have enough income that it's not taking away from kids' resources. But for a lot of families, you know, an expensive smoking habit is impacting kid resources available to children.
Totally.
And binge drinking, again, hard to think about how you're effectively supervising children if you're regularly binge drinking. Now, you can imagine scenarios where people arrange their schedules so that somebody else is in charge of the children on the days that they want to binge drink. And perhaps perhaps that, you know, maybe that doesn't have an impact. But, you know, thinking more broadly, yes.
Right.
There's reasons to think it's hard to effectively parent when you're binge drinking or smoking a lot. And then we could think about what impact that has on your partner. Right. So if you're not able to effectively parent, or if you're putting a big dent in the family budget by purchasing alcohol or smoking, that may be unsettling to your partner and may require them to do more or them to go out without resources. Mm-hmm. And that might make them a less desirable partner.
Right. And then your second one looks at self-reported health, depression, and work limitations. You know, right. It was funny. I heard it was somebody did a study. I forget where I heard it, but it was something like spouses are 10 times more likely to ask whether or not their spouse is cheating on them than if their husband's behavior is related to depression.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Like it's but the role of depression, work limitations and health.
Right. So health status is very different in some, or is different than health behaviors. And, you know, here we don't know about all of the mechanisms, but you might think that if you're dealing with a health problem or a health challenge, it requires different, it changes the dynamics of a couple, potentially. Mm-hmm. It changes what they're able to contribute to the family. It potentially creates caregiving burdens or shifts caregiving burdens within a family. Mm-hmm. In the U.S. context, it also has impacts on family finances, both because of the costs of treatment and lack of insurance, et cetera, but also impacting your ability to earn for your family.
And can you talk a little bit about gender effect?
Right. And so in both articles, both when we're looking at health behaviors and health status or health characteristics, we're interested in thinking about, okay, in the U.S. context, there's different norms for parents based on their gender. We have different norms for mothers and fathers. Of course, not in every family, but broadly, you know, there are different social norms for mothers and fathers. And there are different social norms for folks who are married versus folks who are living together. And we have these stronger norms about how wives and husbands should behave versus how cohabiting partners should behave. And there's a lot of work that suggests that there's stronger gender norms in marriage than in cohabitation.
I can tell you that from my experience.
Right? And so this doesn't mean that everyone adheres to them. Or that in any particular couple that there are stronger norms or different norms, or that things would change or not when folks get married. But in general, there's the sense that there are different norms. And so we expected some health behaviors and some health conditions to have a different impact or have a different association with union dissolution for married versus cohabiting couples and for mothers versus fathers. And for example, there's a lot of work that suggests men deal with depression differently than women do. Men are less likely to seek treatment, and the way that depression manifests itself looks a little different on average in men than women. And so men are more likely to exhibit aggression or aggressive behaviors when they suffer from depression. And so you might think that that would be particularly disruptive to family dynamics, men's aggressive behaviors, or men are more likely to self-medicate with alcohol. Again, that may be more detrimental to family life than women's withdrawal from family life, for example.
So what did you find? What were the gender effects that you found?
Yeah, so we found that men's depression or father's depression is more strongly associated with union dissolution than women's or the mother's. We found that mother's self-rated health, married mother's self-rated health, poor self-rated health predicts dissolution. Now, why would it be married women's and not cohabiting women's? We don't know. And self-rated health captures a lot of different health conditions. Unfortunately, in the data that we were able to analyze, we don't have more detail about what's going on there. And then lastly, we found that married fathers' health-related work limitations predicted divorce. And so if you have a health condition that limits your ability to be employed, it didn't impact whether couples broke up if it was the mom who had that work-limiting health condition, or if it were was a cohabiting father. But if it was a married father, it did predict divorce. And we think that reflects that there's still a very strong norm in the U.S. for male breadwinning in marriage, especially among parents.
For cohabiting, was it also for those cohabiting?
No. So cohabiting fathers who have these work limitations, we don't see that associated with dissolution. Now, there could be some reasons, like the cohabiting couples break up at much higher rates to begin with. And so it may be that they're just not together long enough. Or that fewer of them are together long enough. But here we think there's reasonably strong evidence here that it's about different norms, or that it might be partially about different norms about breadwinning.
Yeah, I think that's amazing.
And then the other thing that I found interesting in your paper was this argument that, you know, we hear people argue for marriage by saying, you know, married people live longer and they're healthier, happier. But your study suggests that there might be people afflicted by health problems might be getting selected out of marriages. So we're only looking at the healthy remainders.
Yes. And, you know, I should say that that is part of the story. I think there's some good evidence, though, that it's only part of the story, and that there might be this treatment effect of marriage on health, that couples engage in different caretaking behaviors, different health monitoring behaviors. They have access to different resources when they're married versus when they're cohabiting. And so, you know, my read of the evidence is that for some types of couples, there does seem to be a marriage impact on their health, but there is also this big thing where, men and women who engage in risky health behaviors don't tend to stay married as long. Men and women who have certain types of health conditions are more likely to be divorced. So it's both. and we don't have, you know, the world's best evidence, because we don't randomly assign people to marriage. We don't randomly assign people to break up. But I think the available evidence suggests, yes, part of the story is that people who have certain types of health challenges are more likely to divorce, and people who engage in certain kinds of risky health behaviors are more likely to divorce.
So what about in sickness and in health, though? Isn't that what marriage is supposed to be about?
Yes. And in fact, one of our early titles for this article was In Sickness and in Health.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Somebody else had already used that title.
Oh, for sure. Oh, that's the pits. That's the worst.
Right. So that was one of the competing hypotheses. I mean, you might have this hypothesis that, you know, married couples have a stronger bond because they explicitly in their vows, not always, but often, pledge in sickness and in health. And in some ways we see that, but we also see that there's stronger norms about what married couples should be doing, and strong, you know, and to the extent that health interferes with being the kind of spouse that in the U.S. today we expect in a marriage, It's problematic. One of my colleagues here at Northwestern, Eli Finkel, who's a psychologist, has this great book on, you know, what we expect from marriages today and how that's somewhat realistic. You know, we expect marriage to fulfill all of these personal fulfillment goals, and we expect our spouses to do all of these things and to be our everything. And that's a really high bar that few marriages can hit, right?
Yeah, totally.
So in generations past, people expected something different from marriage. They expected their spouse to help take care of their kids. They expected their spouse maybe to be a partner in household production. Mm-hmm. But they didn't expect their spouse to help them reach this high level of fulfillment and to be, you know, their primary conversation partner and their primary this and their only that, and to fulfill all their deepest emotional needs. That's a new expectation that we have of marriage.
So is it, do you think that there's a selection effect, you know, where maybe traditionally minded people, you know, with sort of traditional views choose marriage and those who cohabit?
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm sure that's part of it. I'm sure that's part of it, but that should have run against my findings or our findings that some of these health conditions predicted split up more among marriage than among cohabitation. Absolutely. And we try to take that into account a little bit in our statistical models. So we include things like a measure of whether both partners go to church or go to religious services weekly. We include a measure of gender ideology, right? Because if it's really just about folks with the most gender traditional roles are married, or folks who attend religious services weekly are married, then we should have been able to sort of control for that a little bit. That said, there's all these reasons people marry and or don't marry that are really hard to capture in a statistical model. So there's certainly selection into marriage, but we're looking at, in some ways, the selection out of marriage. And that's interesting too.
So like you've thought about marriage, I guess you've been pondering over it for quite a while. So like through this journey, like what's marriage all about then?
a lot of different things to a lot of different people.
Rats. Yeah, I mean, that's probably the right answer, as it often is, right?
All right. A lot of different things to a lot of different people. That said, we have certain social expectations in the U.S., and some of them are changing, but some of them are not. Yeah. So most mothers with young children work today. Mm-hmm. But we still seem to have this expectation that fathers need to be breadwinners.
Yeah.
And, you know, in some ways that undermines a lot of marriages where the father, for various reasons, either structural reasons, the kind of job he used to work in has disappeared, health reasons, he doesn't have the health to do that, discrimination, you know, that he has a criminal record and his, you know, he's effectively been banned from employment. I mean, there's lots of reasons why men and fathers who'd like to be working can't. And this strong social norm might undercut what would otherwise be stable marriages.
You've been listening to The Annex, a sociology podcast. A special thank you to Christine Percheski of Northwestern University. We discussed two of her articles today, Health Behaviors and Union Dissolution Among Parents of Young Children, Differences by Marital Status in PLOS One, and Health and Union Dissolution Among Parenting Couples, Differences by Gender and Marital Status in the Journal of Health and Social Behavior. We're on the web, theannexpodcast.com, on Twitter at SocAnnex, and on Facebook, The Annex Sociology Podcast. Our producer is Liseth Moreno. On behalf of Leslie Hinkson, who had to leave early, and Gabriel Rossman, who couldn't make it today, I'm Joe Cohen. Thanks for listening.